So Eric Nelson will be speaking for us this morning and telling us about how he fits in and fitting in with birds and fish and ethics. And so we're going to hear about how, probably a little bit about how he grew up in nature and his love of the animals. And he's a wildlife biologist and has worked for many years for Fish and Wildlife in this area in the Mississippi River. And so he really knows well the animals around us. And what a joy to have him lead a bird walk with us last weekend. And so I'm especially pleased to welcome Eric this morning.
This is my fishing shirt, but I also go bird watching in it. And I was given this label called Guide.
Come a little closer to the mic.
See, I don't know what to do here. Okay, is that better? Yeah. I'm a bird guide, not a fishing guide, but everyone's do better. But my bird watching shirt is underneath. Okay, yes. Debbie gave me that a while ago. It might be a little faded, I wear it a lot. But I like the spirit in it. Thanks, Debbie. So, this is where we went. To see the crowd out there last weekend, Sunday? This is where we went birding, at the Wagon Bridge end, and this is the new Flyway Bridge. And I just haven't had a photo of it. And so, out there, there were 12 to 15 of us, I guess, something like in that order, and we saw 31 species of birds, and there's a few, and there's a few more, and it kind of features, we had white pelicans, and we had bluebirds, and we had a couple warblers, woodpeckers were well represented out there, things like that, so it was a nice day. I really enjoyed everybody out there and glad to look at it. So here's more of my talk of, call it fitting in. I guess, is that focused or about spirituality? It's supposed to talk about spirituality, and I take spirituality as helping me fit in. And fitting in is a concern that, where am I comfortable? And comfort is spiritual to me. I'm comfortable in nature. I'm comfortable in, I want to be comfortable in nature. I want to be comfortable in society and with myself and with people in general. And I think we all have our avenue, all have our path. I've got a couple that are well-worn, I'll tell you that. And it's a spiritual path. I might not talk about spiritual too much, but it shows up in various forms. And that's what I want to get to. Watching birds, catching fish, learning ethics, growing up. So I wanted to try... As some of you are aware that Tex Hawkins and I go way back for 35 years or whatever it is, and he is a prolific writer and a wonderful speaker and has these ideas that keep pounding. He's still doing it at his age, and he has written a book called Cosmic Conscience, Knowing Nature's God. And He highlights this by saying he looks at what our founding fathers and other existentialists did in developing democracy in a conscientious manner through God and nature. And then more recently, Costa Rica's leaders, which he's very familiar with Costa Rica, chose to govern in a conscientious manner, emphasizing sustainability, and that by a cosmic intelligence, and compassion. And this ubiquitous nature's God, as he calls it, are represented in all living things, and maybe non-living things, as we know. And he says they're all glued by love. And the thing of, go Unitarians, right? And I kind of liked that theme that he is starting to, he's got it figured out. I don't really have it figured out, but I like to try to verbalize it. So how do I be talk about? Okay, this is a lake place in western Minnesota where I have grown up. My father grew up. It was purchased by my grandfather in 1917, so we're well over centennial here. And this 63-acre area is kind of a mecca for our family. And Debbie has been very gracious in dealing with what that entails. You know, traditions are kind of over the top, which I won't get into. But it was real, and this was my nature connection. And my dad started catching fish at an early time, 1920. And then in the 50s, it's when I start remembering things about it. We finally got electricity. My family's on the right, my parents and my sister and me, and then my grandfather, my dad, and my sister. She took care of me all along, you know. And this is in 1947. I'm a year and a half old, you know. And it's a nice connection to remember. And growing up, we were brother and sister, and so, yeah, we didn't always get along, but now that we're old, hey, we're in there, you know, we're together. It's great. This is the cabin, which we call the cottage. Very inviting, big screen porches and the lake and so forth. And so we still fish. My daughter there on the left, we have had prairie burns. It's a kind of a sanctified place, if that's the right word. We have ashes of my parents there. Other, you know, we distribute. Here are my kids distributing ashes of my mother not too long ago. Okay, that's brief, real brief, good and brief. Vietnam, what'd that have to do with nature? Well, monsoons, heat, humidity, mosquitoes, other stinging critters. Of course, Vietnam was a huge factor in my life, but I didn't think that I took much from there to make me a birder or a fisherman. It was more like a survival mode. And so that's what I'm going to say about that. Education was after Vietnam, and that really, I was enlightened. I went to UW Stevens Point, and that's where I was exposed to Aldo Leopold and his land ethic. And Aldo was a professor at University of Wisconsin-Madison back in the 40s and 50s, and he developed a land ethic. It evolved in himself, and the ethic goes like this: a thing is right when it tends to preserve the integrity, stability, and beauty of the biotic community. It is wrong when it tends otherwise. So a nice right and wrong ethic. I remember Jeff Falk, Joan and Schnabel, Jeff. He always asked me these weirdest questions. He says, what do you mean an ethic? How can there be a land ethic? Well, I could quote him this, and he got quiet, way to go. But I like that part too. He had a description for the land that I think is important for us to think about. And his description is that it includes soils, waters, plants, and animals, or collectively the land. It changes the role of Homo sapiens from conqueror heart, seventh item, seventh principle, said the days, that kind of thing. So Tex and I, back in 2018, actually gave a class about Aldo Leopold's teachings at the senior university. That was a fun time. We enjoyed that. We ended up with a field trip at the shack where Aldo Leopold brought to life a ramshackle place. On to birding. Yeah, birding's my favorite, I guess. So why I watch birds? I got emotional here. It's just seeing is believing. I learn the facts, and then I see it, and it comes to life, of course. We've got these things. We all have these kind of connections with this people, or is it whatever? And here's an example. This is the golden wing warbler. It weighs about an ounce and a half. It flies well over, about 3,000 miles from Venezuela to here. And the return trip, he leaves 4 years, maybe 4 years. And this map shows I'm going to switch here a little. Oh, you got it. I'm going to stand back so I can look at the. This does show the wintering grounds in South America and Central America. Migrates through here, and the red includes part of Minnesota. That's where they breed. So that's pretty much of a miracle right there. It's pretty fantastic. And there are a lot of birds like this that do that. They're called neotropical migrants. They're in the tropics or just above the Tropic of Cancer. And some, yes, I'm supposed to be over here. They're tropicals. There's about 220 neotropical migrants that frequent North America and make that fantastic journey. So I also get to see the habitat. I get in the desert, get in the mountains, get to touch the habitat, so to speak, feel it, understand it more, get in the jungles, get in Trempealeau Refuge or the jungles of Peru. Well, it's meditative. You're concentrating, trying to sense those bird calls. My hearing is terrible. I can't hear much anymore, but with people who do, and I have Merlin on my computer, an app on my phone, but you're using everything. So I just wanted to show you a couple more examples of a big migration. Long migration. The bar-tailed godwit, it weighs almost a pound and a half. This is its migratory route. So it nests in Alaska, and if I've got this right, it flies nonstop. 8 days to New Zealand. Averages 33 miles an hour. It does not stop, so it doesn't get water. It's going over the ocean, can't land in the ocean. Its internal organs and muscles actually shrink. Anyway, so he's there for the summer of the south. Then he flies a mere 6,700 miles to China, and from China another 4,000 miles, and he's back home. My gosh, what is the point? What is it? You know, it's resources. In the end, it's resources. Where they nest, they have 24 hours of sunlight, daylight, basically in Alaska. There's an abundance of food there for them, including insects and the larvae and all that, and aquatic things. And then all of a sudden it's frozen, the tundra. So they get out. Well, I don't know why they chose that far. 18 years old, they're a pretty old bird. That comes up to 320,000 miles. In a lifetime, they fly. And they do this, and their body is depleted. And then they eat, and it's depleted again. And it's a wonder. It's a mystery. You know, there's an advantage. There aren't many competing with them when they're flying. You know, and they get up to 18,000 feet. Some of the songbirds get that high, too, when they migrate. Oh, back locally, in 2008, Tex Hawkins and I kind of skipped out of work for an extended lunch in May. And people were tolerant of the naturalists in us. And we went out to Latch Island and we saw 20 species of warblers in that time. And you can get 20, if you have 26 in a whole season here, you're doing really well, you know. In an hour and a half, blue-winged warbler, golden-winged, Tennessee warbler, Nashville warbler. And these, of course, are photos I did not take. Yellow warbler, orange-crowned. Look at that chestnut-sided. And then the northern parula. This is what you watch for when you want to identify a bird. Is it have a split ring, eye ring, or is it a solid eye ring? Watch for that. Okay, here we go. Cape May warbler. Does the bird have a wing bar? Does it stripey? Magnolia warbler. I did take one picture, the yellow rump warbler. By golly, it has a yellow rump. And the Blackburnian, one of the flashiest. Trying to make this go. Okay, Blackpoll warbler. And from south to north, 4,000 miles. But then when it goes back, they all go to the East Coast, and then they fly over the ocean down to South America. Okay, we don't know why, do we? Palm warbler, northern water thrush, common yellow throat. There's a prothonotary that some of you have seen down in the bottomlands, I bet. That's the 20 we saw. And, you know, it was a big thrill. We couldn't really work the rest of the day. It was mighty fine. Let's see. Oh, more thrills. Costa Rica. This is my daughter, Susie, on the left, and Debbie on the right. We're down there. We see the best bird. I don't say that very often. They're all good. They're all best. But the best bird, Quetzal. Resplendent Quetzal. Resplendent Quetzal. And we're kind of in a area that there's a trees are above us, and then there's bushes around and so forth, and there's other people watching this bird, and it's like it must be curious of us too, right? Okay. And it watched us. A person had a spotting scope on there, and I put my camera up to it, or my phone, and boom, got a beautiful picture. But the body is maybe 8 inches, and the tail's another 12 inches. It's got this cape, or it's like armor or something. Anyway, that was a big thrill. And that was something to remember, something to say, okay, you witnessed this. There's a lot of people in the world have seen it, but you got to be one of them. Then I had a big trip in 2019 to Peru. Steve Mithun and I went on that. Some of you know Steve. We went bird watching from about 16,000 feet in the Andes down to the Amazon, about 353 above sea level. 18 days, we observed 585 species of birds. And wow, that's as good as 20 in a day, in a couple hours, whatever. And I saw a few, there were a couple warblers that we saw, that we see here. I can't remember the names of them right now. Anyway, but we saw some strange looking birds. This guy is a yellow-billed tit tyrant. And then we had the red and green macaws and Inca tern, and this is the long-tailed sylph. We saw 52 species of hummingbirds. Highlight. This was a spiritual event. People held the Andean condor in high esteem. They had carvings throughout Machu Picchu of huge Andean condors, one in a floor that you walk across, you know, round, you know, just honoring it. And it felt it. There were literally 50-100 people around us. It didn't matter. It was really quite another spiritual thing, in that it so stimulating and so awesome. Our guide, a native of Ecuador, he was ecstatic. He says, I come here so often, I never see the condors. You know, we did not see it this close. This is not my picture. But he was speaking in Spanish, and he was speaking in a native tongue. There is the imperial, there is, you know, very godlike representation. So we got to do that. One more birding trip. A year ago, I went on a bird watching safari in Tanzania for 10 days. There we saw 170 species of birds, which, you know, the jungles and the elevations I was at, 500 and some birds. This is more realistic in a plains that situation, basically, in some woods. We went to Lake Victoria as well. On a safari, there's these 10 or 7 animals that you just gotta see. There's like lions and giraffes and hippos and elephants and rhinos. Okay, you gotta see those. Well, they don't have a top 7 birds, but that's my bird list. So this is a lilac-breasted roller, and they're pretty common. That was cool. This is a gray-crowned crane. There are some of those at the Crane Foundation in Baraboo. This is a Cory bustard, and I was supposed to see a Cory bustard for a friend of mine who ties flies with their feathers. He's part of a group that raises them just for the feathers, okay. This is a white-headed vulture. This is a secretary bird, ground bird. They move fast, they're fast, they're always on the go. Really fabulous. This is a little bee eater, and this is that owl again. Burroughs, Hawk, I don't know where to go with that. So fishing was kind of a, I'm going to wrap it up here. My book group read a book called Mysticism, and man, that was a thick book and hard for me, but it was interesting. In that book, the author quoted Herman Melville as he contemplated the sea, and he said, "The sea is the image of the ungraspable phantom of life." Well, that's pretty good. That's pretty amazing. We have Lake Winona or something, the Mississippi. But that took us places, but I'm not going to go there now. The other great quote is from Henry David Thoreau. He says, "Time is but the stream I go a-fishing in." And that was my other favorite t-shirt. I had that on a t-shirt. Wore that one out. And this is a river that I fish a lot in northern Wisconsin. And you know, you're in the flowing water, and as they say, that you don't step in the same river every, same place every time it passes through. And you do get to start thinking about other things, or just zeroing in on your present condition. You don't want to slip and fall, and you want the bait in the right place, but then you're saying, gee, it's really nice here, I feel good, the movement of the water, refreshing, so forth. So that is an important thing to me. So this is just a few days ago. Ain't nature great? And there's Debbie and her son, Jonah, and me at Pike's Peak in Iowa, looking over the Mississippi River. So with that, I'll end. Thank you.